You're listening to the Hour of the Time. I'm William Cooper. Ladies and gentlemen, we've got some good news tonight. So stay tuned, and we'll let you know what it is. Well, why not let you know what it is now? So that's what we'll do. Let me go down to our page here and load it up. By the way, if you want to get updates on what's going on here, you can access our web pages, harvest-trust.org. That's harvest-trust.org. We received word on Sunday from sources within the local policing agencies that the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been put on notice by several ranking local law enforcement personnel that, and I quote, "We will absolutely not allow another Ruby Ridge or Waco to occur in Apache County, Arizona," end quote. Glenn Jacobs, the owner and publisher of the Round Valley Paper, spoke personally last night to the Apache County Sheriff. According to Glenn, the sheriff told him, quote, "I have put the FBI on notice that they are not welcome to come into this county and harass the Cooper family," end quote. That's really good news around here. Let me take you to our most recent news flash. This will be very interesting to some of you, and hopefully to all of you, who are just tired of the tyranny that's taking place in this country. The latest on our ongoing investigation into the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City has uncovered the following. Number one, John Doe, number two, has been positively identified by the intelligence service. He is currently in federal custody, which means being protected, at this moment. The federal government has protected and hidden the identity of this criminal because he is an agent or informant for the United States government. The ethnic and religious background of John Doe number two is not known at this time. Number two, John Doe number three has been positively identified as a West German intelligence operative, CIA controlled. The ethnic and religious background of John Doe number three is not known at this time. Number three, John Doe number four has been positively identified by the intelligence service. He has never been questioned by any law enforcement agency in connection with the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building. John Doe number four was also involved with the Waco massacre in 1993. John Doe number four is an informant of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, known as the BATF. John Doe number four masquerades as an American patriot. We also do not know the ethnic and religious background of him at this time. John Doe number five has been positively identified by the intelligence service as a major fundraiser for the Oklahoma City bombing operation. He is at this time in custody in the Netherlands. John Doe number five is Jewish. He is most probably an agent of the Central Intelligence Agency, the Mossad, and or the Anti-Defamation League. Number five, Mike Vanderbo of the so-called John Doe Times is an agent of the Anti-Defamation League masquerading as a patriot commander of the Alabama 1st Cavalry Militia. The militia which he claims to command does not exist. It is a fraud. His purpose is to place the blame for the Oklahoma City bombing on patriots and the lawful militia, attributing a motive of white supremacist anti-Semitism and racism. The Branch Davidians, this is item number 6, the Branch Davidians, ladies and gentlemen, were a racial mix of mostly black, Hispanic, and had even a couple of Jewish members. Only a very small minority of that church was Caucasian, white. Racist, white supremacist, anti-Semites would rejoice at their death, ladies and gentlemen, not seek revenge. Racist, white supremacist, anti-Semites do not avenge the death of blacks, Hispanics, Orientals, and Jews. Number 7, the people who worked in the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building were mostly Caucasian white people and could not ever have been the target of racist, white supremacist, anti-Semites. Racist, white supremacist, anti-Semites do not murder white people. Number 8, the Ku Klux Klan and white supremacist groups expressed dissatisfaction with the manner in which the BATF and FBI were handling the situation in Waco, Texas, and actually called for an assault by the government to end the standoff. A contingent of the Ku Klux Klan white supremacists traveled to Waco, Texas to offer their services to the BATF and FBI in order to effect the arrests of the Branch Davidians. Number 9. Prominent members of the Anti-Defamation League made public statements which were carried by the major news networks, which we recorded and are keeping in a safe place. These recordings disclosed that the ADL had the perpetrators under surveillance for 2 years. That's their figure, not ours. The spokesman for the ADL stated that they knew the bombing was going to happen well in advance. Number 10, the leader of Elohim City is an BATF FBI informant and has been such an informant for many years. Number 11, Carol Howe was a BATF informant and disclosed the plans of the bombing and those involved to the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms. After the bombing occurred, she made public statements that the BATF knew well beforehand that the building was going to be bombed, knew who was involved, and knew approximately exactly when it was going to happen. The BATF attempted to imprison Carol Howe in order to silence her, but they lost their case and she's still talking. Number 12, Governor Keating. Governor Keating's brother, who wrote a book, supposedly a fiction, years before the bombing occurred, about a group of radical white ring extremists who blow up a federal building. The ringleader's name is McVeigh. Representative Edward Istook, Democrat of Oklahoma, the Anti-Defamation League, the FBI, the BATF, the United States Marshal Service, Oklahoma City Fire Department, the Oklahoma City Police Department, and the Oklahoma City Bomb Squad all knew the bombing would occur well in advance of April 19, 1995. The American intelligence community knew of the plans to detonate a bomb in the heartland of America as early as 1971 and wrote about it in a top-secret document called Majesty 12, which contains the plan for the disarmament of the American people and the implementation of a worldwide socialist totalitarian government. Number 14. The Oklahoma City bombing was a joint operation involving intelligence operatives of the United States, Germany, and Israel. The purpose of the bombing was to strike terror into the heartland of America, destroying the illusion that such things only happen in places like New York, Los Angeles, or foreign capitals. Those responsible believed the bombing could be blamed on patriots, militia, or religious fundamentalists to prepare American citizens to more readily accept personal disarmament in preparation for world socialist totalitarian government under the United Nations. 15. The names of those John Does involved, the names of witnesses, the documentation of proof has been dispersed to our most trusted agents for safekeeping until Constitution no Republican government is restored, at which time the guilty parties will be arrested for trial by a jury of their peers. Number 16, William Cooper, Harvest Trust, and the Intelligence Service are not racists. We are not white supremacists. We are not anti-Semitic. We are tired of seeing the American people manipulated with these terms and by special interest groups such as the Anti-Defamation League and many others. They're not the only ones. We are interested only in the truth. A great man once said, some of you know who he is. Those of you who don't, I suggest you seek him out. He said, and I quote, "Seek ye the truth, and the truth will make you free." End quote. Stay tuned now for some fantastic information that I gave to those who attended our conference on May the 25th, 1998, at the Thunder Horse Ranch.
Okay, now, this afternoon, you've got me. You know what that means? That means you're going to be taking copious notes and learning something. And what I'm going to teach you is some incredible information that some of you may know, most of you don't know even exists, probably. And if you pay attention, we'll set you free. Now, I've had a personal policy in the past of never teaching anybody anything about law. I am not a lawyer. I am not going to teach you to be a lawyer. What I am going to teach you today is not going to make you some kind of wizard that can go into court and solve all your problems. I am not giving you legal advice. I'm going to teach you what I know and what a lot of other people know. Okay? I've studied for many, many years. I work with people like Lawrence Beecraft, who's one of the preeminent faith youth attorneys in this country. I work with a lot of other people across the country who are digging, Dan Metter, for instance, who are digging to uncover the truth in the law instead of the deception that we are used to dealing with. And we share our information. And if you watch Veritas or have been reading Veritas for very long, you've seen some of it printed in there. Some of it is so strange and so weird compared to the fantasy land that we've been taught to believe in that people find it just too fantastic to believe. But the truth is, once you learn this stuff, people like me find the fantasy that all the rest of the people are living in too fantastic to believe. It's as if the human race really doesn't have a brain and is incapable of original thought, or deductive reasoning, or any kind of investigative or research ability, or else they just don't give a damn, and if they don't give a damn, they're going to get exactly what they deserve, which they're going to be, the end result of that is they're going to be once again enslaved as they were for most of human history. And I've got to turn this down again because you hear feedback.
This will, of course, continue tomorrow, ladies and gentlemen. You're going to learn an awful lot. Make sure you take good notes.
Try that. Testing. Can you still hear me? Hear feedback?
No.
Great. Okay. The reason I'm going to give you this is to give you an understanding that what you thought about the law is wrong. I'm going to teach you some things about the Internal Revenue Service also today. And believe me, once you know this, what I'm going to tell you doesn't mean you can take it and run down and cure all your Internal Revenue Service woes. To get into that battle, it's a real battle, and you've got to be stubborn like me, and you've got to draw the line and be willing to fight the fight and die if you have to for the right thing. Because that's really what you got to do. Because those guys, when they come after you, they don't quit. And it's just a forever battle. I've been battling them for 12 years. So far, I'm winning. They could drop out of the sky tomorrow and kill me. That's the kind of battle it is. So we live in uncertainty. I happen to know from watching them that I'm safe for another year. Because I'm a leader in the patriot community. If and when they ever come after me, it will be a few weeks before April 15th. April 15th just went by, so I'm safe for another year. The reason they would do that is they see, you were listening to this guy, you thought he had it, you know, you better file and pay your income taxes because we took him down, we'll take you down too. That's why they do that. That's why they do it right before April 15th. Okay? So this will give you a basis upon which to found a program of research and investigation through which, after a long time of study and work, you can stand toe-to-toe to with them and fight the battle like me and many other people are. And if you're really a principled individual who really believes in the principles and ideals which you all tell me that you believe in, sooner or later you must draw a line and say, enough is enough, I'm going to fight the battle because it is the right thing to do and for no other reason. Fear be damned, kill me be damned, take all my possessions be damned. I must do this because it is the right thing to do. And until people do that, you're in danger of going backwards in the evolutionary course of human history. See, for most of the history of the human race, we were slaves. We were owned by somebody, some king, some queen, some sultan, some emir, or some dude that just had a bigger axe. You know? When they created the United States of America, it was the first time in the history of the entire human race that any people had ever been free. And we're going to give it back. I don't understand it. It's the ultimate achievement, in my estimation, of humankind. To give man freedom and hold him responsible for his actions. To go backwards into slavery, or into some kind of feudal system, or some system where we give up our rights in exchange for a promise of security and food on the table and all that kind of stuff is an admission of absolute incompetence on the road of life. It's an admission that we're not adults, we're children. It's an admission that we can't use our brain, that we don't deserve to be free. It's complete capitulation is what it is. Surrender to childhood. I've said this many times and I'll say it again. Most people, here's what they do. They spend the first 18 to 21 years of their life struggling against their parents to become free and responsible and strike out on their own. Right, Melissa? Melissa just graduated from high school. She can't wait to go to college and get out on her own. Now, here's what happens to most people I'm not saying this is going to happen to you, Melissa. I don't know. You don't know yet either. But you're going to find out real quick, and so will everybody who's going to be watching you. So you get out there, and then you find out, hey, this ain't no easy life. This ain't no cream puff, man. It's rough out here. And if I don't make these payments, they come and take this stuff. My credit record's ruined. I can't ever charge anything. Blah, 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 blah. I can't get a job. Blah, 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 blah. All there is, you know, and nobody wants to hire me because I'm too young, but I can get a job dishwashing, but I don't want to dishwash, and blah, 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 blah. And so after 10 or 15 years of this crap, struggling against the system to make it, people say, screw this. I want to be a little child again. I want a daddy to take care of me. That's why socialism is so attractive to most people. It promises you a clean diaper. It promises you a place to sleep. It promises you a bottle of milk, and you can suck on the nipple all you want to, and it will never go empty. Promise you that they will give you a job or something to do, and if you don't want to work, they'll still feed you and take care of you and put you to bed, tell you what time you can get up, what time you can go to bed, and if you can drive or if you can't drive, and you're going to be safe because they won't let the criminals come in and get you and all that kind of stuff. A lot of people give up struggling to be free and revert back to childhood, and socialism then becomes the daddy. That's what's so attractive about it. That's why people suck up socialism. It lets you be the child again that you left behind. So, way back there. Along with my hair, Bob's hair. It's back there somewhere. Right, Bob? But if you understand what that truly means, it means enslavement. And if you love freedom like I do, it is the most distasteful, most terrible consequence or end result that I could possibly imagine. Because being a child under socialism is no different than being a child in a home where you couldn't choose your parents and they may not be good parents. And they can be good or bad at will. And you have not responsibilities or rights, you have privileges. And daddy can give you privileges or take them away anytime he wants. And if daddy gets real mad at you, he can really abuse you, can't he? He can really beat your butt and send you to your room, kick your ass, and slam the door and lock you in the barn or whatever he wants to do. Because daddies can do that. And by and large, all governmental systems, no matter what they start out to be, disintegrate into tyranny. Because the governmental system will accumulate power as long as it can until it becomes omnipotent and you become the worm that means nothing. All governments will proceed in that direction until they're stopped or they decay and disintegrate. When the Founding Fathers established the United States of America, they put into place checks and balances, created a contract called the Constitution between the states and what they created, the federal government, that limited the powers of the federal government, protected the rights of the states and the people, and granted to government certain restricted, limited powers so that it could conduct its business for the general welfare and good of the states and of the people. It wasn't supposed to ever be what it is today. It has done what all governments do. It began ignoring its limitations, conning the people into believing that it has powers that it does not, exceeding its limitations, grabbing and bringing to it powers that it does not have and has never had. And I'm going to reveal some of that to you today so that hopefully you will be brought to a state of awareness and awakenness, and you can be a real people instead of what I call a sheeple. And if you go out the door, look just to the left outside the door, you'll see there's a bench or a couple of chairs there with some wool sheep's hide on it. That's from last year. Some guys came, they were sheeple. When they left the wool behind and they became real people. And so it's on display for all to see. Okay. Now, we gave you a pad and we gave you a pen. And the reason we gave you that is so you will use it. So I want to see furious writing going on while I'm talking. Okay? In the United States, this is federal jurisdiction. And this is going to blow your mind. Everything I'm going to give you today is going to blow your mind, literally. Federal jurisdiction. By the way, this was written by Lawrence Beecraft, a good friend of mine, and as I already told you, one of the preeminent patriot attorneys in this country. In the United States, there are two separate and distinct jurisdictions. One being that of the states within their own territorial boundaries, and the other being the federal jurisdiction. So the two jurisdictions are the states within their own territorial boundaries and the federal jurisdiction. Broadly speaking, state jurisdiction encompasses the legislative power to regulate, control, and govern real and personal property. Individuals and enterprises within the territorial limits of any given state. It's important that you understand that. Legislative power to regulate, control, and govern real and personal property, individuals, and enterprises within the territorial limits of any given state. In contrast, federal jurisdiction is extremely limited. Anyone who's ever read the Constitution cannot but be aware of that fact. With the same being exercised only in areas external to state legislative power and territory. Now, what did I just say? Federal government has no authority or jurisdiction within the territorial boundary of any of the several states of the Union. Then what are they doing there? They're exceeding their power. They're exceeding their jurisdiction. They are committing crimes. They're behaving in a criminal manner, operating under the color of law. They are outlaws. And I tell them that when I see them. You're an outlaw. You're not a gangster. Oh, I'm just doing my job. No, you're not. You're an outlaw. Read this and give them a copy of the Constitution. Go read it. Then you come back and tell me what you are. They never come back. Never. And they don't quit their job. You know why? So they have a wife at home.
You can't quit your job. You worked in a job for 10 years. If you quit your job, we lose all the safety and security and medical benefits and all this, and I won't sleep with you ever again.
Right? It's the truth. Part of the control mechanism is to teach women that men must provide them with security. If men can't do that, they're worthless. So they can't quit. Or they lose their family. They lose their children. They lose their wife. They lose their life. I'm not saying anything against women. Women are like the rest of us. We have all been brainwashed to fit the role of manipulated or manipulator within a control system. And we all function, for the most part, exactly like the little lemmings that they want us to be. Happens to be the truth. And it's spelled out real explicitly in chapter 1 of my book, Behold the Pale Horse, which is Silent Weapons for Quiet Wars. It talks about the family and family structure and how it works to maintain the control mechanism for the state. Notwithstanding the clarity of this simple principle, the line of demarcation between these two jurisdictions and the extent and reach of each has become somewhat blurred due to popular misconceptions and the efforts expended by the federal government to conceal one of its major weaknesses. Only by resorting to history and case law can this obfuscation be clarified and the two distinct jurisdictions be readily seen. Obfuscation means hidden veils. Smokescreen. The original 13 colonies of America were each separately established by charters from the English crown. outside of the common bond of each being a dependency and colony of the mother country, England, the colonies were not otherwise united. Each had its own governor, legislative assembly, and courts. Each was governed separately and independently by the English Parliament. Now, don't get the crown confused with the queen. Does anybody know the difference between the crown and the queen? What is it?
The crown is in the middle of London,
I thought it was square. The crown is the 1 mile square Masonic entity which controls the Bank of England called the City of London. The queen is something entirely different. So what does that tell you? The ruler of the colonies was the Bank of England, a Masonic controlled organization. The political connections of the separate colonies to the English crown and parliament descended into a rebellious state of affairs as the direct result of parliamentary acts adopted in the late 1760s and early 1770s. Due to the real and perceived dangers caused by these various acts, the First Continental Congress was convened by representatives of the several colonies on October of 1970. Due to the real and perceived dangers caused by these various acts, the First Continental Congress was convened by representatives of the several colonies on October of 1974. In October of 1774. And its purpose was to submit a petition of grievances to the British Parliament and Crown. It really served quite a different purpose, though, didn't it? Because what did it produce? What did they produce from that? Anybody ever hear the Declaration of Independence? By the Declaration and Resolves of the First Continental Congress, dated October 14, 1774, the colonial representatives labeled these parliamentary acts of which they complained as impolitic, unjust, and cruel, as well as unconstitutional and most dangerous and destructive of American rights. But further, they asserted that these acts manifested designs, schemes, and plans which demonstrate a system formed to enslave America. And that's what's happening now. And with that emboldened appeal, presentation of that grievance to the crown, they went even further and declared their independence within just a short period of time. I don't think if they hadn't done that particular exercise of trying to enumerate their grievances and petition the crown, that there ever would have been a Declaration of Independence. Because most people live in fear. So you take a step, and if your foot doesn't get chopped off, you tend to take another step, right? Well, that's basically how it works. Matters grew worse, and between October 1775 and the middle of 1776, each of the colonies separately severed their ties and relations with England, and several adopted constitutions for the newly formed states. By July 1776, the exercise of British authority in all of the colonies was not recognized in any degree. The capstone of this actual separation of the colonies from England was the more formal Declaration of Independence. And then war. Matters grew worse between October 1775 and the middle of 1776. Each of the colonies separately severed their ties and relations with England, and several adopted constitutions. Excuse me, I just read that paragraph. The legal effect of the Declaration of Independence was to make each new state a separate and independent sovereign over which there was no other government of superior power or jurisdiction. This was clearly shown in McIlvaine versus Cox, Cox's Lessee, 8 United States, or 8 U.S. Supreme Court, 4 Branch, 209, 212, 1808, where it was held by the court. Quote, this opinion is predicated upon a principle which is believed to be undeniable, that the several states which composed this union, so far at least as regarded their municipal regulations, became entitled from the time when they declared themselves independent to all the rights and powers of sovereign states, and that they did not derive them from concessions made by the British king. The Treaty of Peace contains a recognition of their independence, not a grant of it. A recognition. From hence it results that the laws of the several state governments were the laws of sovereign states, and as such were obligatory upon the people of such state from the time they were enacted. End quote. The consequences of independence was again explained in Harcourt v. Gilliard, 25 United States Supreme Court, 12 Wheat, 523, 526, 527, 1827, where the Supreme Court stated, quote, there was no territory within the United States that was claimed in any other right than that of some one of the Confederated States. Therefore, there could be no acquisition of territory made by the United States distinct from or independent of some one of the states. Each declared itself sovereign and independent according to the limits of its territory. Notice that everything depends upon territorial boundaries and limits. The soil and sovereignty within their acknowledged limits were as much theirs as the Declaration of Independence as at this hour. End quote. Thus, unequivocally, in July 1776, the new states possessed all sovereignty, power, and jurisdiction over all the soil and persons in their respective territorial limits. This condition of supreme sovereignty of each state over all property and persons within the borders thereof continued notwithstanding the adoption of the Articles of Confederation. Article 2 of that document declared, quote, Article 2, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled, end quote. Do you know the difference between an act of Congress and an act of an act in Congress assembled? Anybody know the difference between an act of Congress and an act produced in Congress assembled? Yes.
It's the way it's recorded in the Federal Register.
Well, it was one thing, but that's not the real major difference. No, an act of Congress does not apply to the states or the citizens of the states. An act produced in Congress assembled applies to the states and to anybody engaged in any activity over which the federal government has been given limited power by the Constitution of the United States of America. And in the United States Attorney's Handbook, it clearly states an act of Congress has no authority within the states or over the citizens of the states. Does not apply. But you'll never get a United States attorney to admit that. As the history of the Confederation government demonstrated, each state was indeed sovereign and independent to such a degree that it made the central government created by the Confederation fairly ineffectual. These defects of the Confederation government strained the relations between and among the states, and the remedy became the calling of a constitutional convention. But you see, even Larry can make mistakes because that's not the truth. They did not call a constitutional convention. History clearly shows that the several states of the Confederation sent delegates to sit down and amend the Articles of Confederation in order to make the Confederation stronger, to make it work in manners that it was not working. What did the Founding Fathers do when they got there? They took a vote, and since they had a majority, and since they were sitting, they threw out what their states had sent them to do and did something that they were not empowered to do. They created a constitution and changed the government. Were they authorized to do that? No. So actually what they did was an outlaw thing. they did something that they were not empowered to do. Their states did not send them there. The colonies didn't send them there to do that. They had no power to do it whatsoever. How many of you heard of recently the attempt to create a conference of the states in the last several years? Raise your hands. What they were trying to do was the same thing the Founding Fathers did. They wanted to get a majority of the states to send representatives to the conference of the states where they would, by majority vote, create a new government and throw the Constitution in the trash can. That's what that was all about. They were trying to duplicate what the Founding Fathers did when they created this country, founded upon the Constitution. Since they were not empowered to do that, and since the Constitution does not abrogate or destroy or amend or abolish the Articles of Confederation, the Articles of Confederation are still part of the law in this country. How many of you knew that? The representatives, which assembled in Philadelphia in May 1787 to attend the Constitutional Convention, met, and it wasn't a constitutional convention. It was a convention convened to find out remedies to amend the Articles of Confederation and make the Confederation work and cure the problems which they perceived that it had. They met for the primary purpose of improving the commercial relations among the states, although the product of the convention was more than this, but no intention was demonstrated for the states to surrender in any degree the jurisdiction so possessed by them at that time. And indeed, the Constitution, as finally drafted, continued the same territorial jurisdiction of the states as existed under the Articles of Confederation. Since they did not abolish the Articles of Confederation, they had no choice. The essence of this retention of state jurisdiction was embodied in Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution for the United States of America, which defined federal jurisdiction as follows in get this, okay, this is very important. You know, the Founding Fathers, when they wrote the Constitution, they didn't write something that had to be interpreted. These were geniuses. They understood the English language better than anybody living today. And if you get an 1828 Webster's Dictionary, which basically was the same English language that they spoke and wrote, you can read their writing according to the meaning defined in that dictionary, and you can understand what it was they said without any Supreme Court or anybody else having to come along and tell you what they meant or what their intent was or what they wrote. It's clear. Quote, to exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever. Whoa, that's pretty heavy, isn't it? I mean, there's no limitations on that, is there? But they can do anything they want, can't they? No. Because listen to this. Over such district, not exceeding 10 miles square. Now listen to what I just said. Not exceeding 10 miles square. That's why an act of Congress does not apply to the states or the citizens of the states. An act of Congress only has jurisdiction over, as may by session of particular states and the acceptance of Congress become the seat of government of the United States and to exercise like authority over all places purchased. Are you listening carefully, folks? Constitution is clear. These people are way outside their bounds. To exercise exclusive legislation in all cases whatsoever over such a district, not exceeding 10 miles square, as may, by session of particular states and the acceptance of Congress, become the seat of the government of the United States, and to exercise like authority over all places purchased by the consent of the legislature of the state in which the same shall be for the erection of forts, magazines, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. Period. End quote. That's it. The reason for the inclusion of this clause in the Constitution is obvious. Under the Articles of Confederation, the states retained full and complete jurisdiction over lands and persons within their borders. The Congress under the Articles of Confederation was merely a body which represented and acted as agents of the separate states for external affairs, and it had no jurisdiction within the states, period. This defect in the Articles made the Confederation Congress totally dependent upon any given state for protection, and this dependency did, in fact, cause embarrassment for that Congress and for the Confederation as a whole. During the Revolutionary War, while the Congress met in Philadelphia, a body of mutineers from the Continental Army surrounded the Congress and chastised and insulted its members. The governments of both Philadelphia and Pennsylvania proved themselves powerless to remedy this situation, so Congress was forced to flee, first to Princeton, New Jersey, and finally to Annapolis, Maryland. Thus, this clause was inserted into the Constitution to give jurisdiction to Congress over its capital and such other places which Congress might purchase for forts, magazines, arsenals, and other needful buildings wherein the state ceded jurisdiction of such lands to the federal government. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that Congress can send an agent into the state of Arizona and purchase a piece of land and set up a building and now they have authority over that building and that land?
Not without the legislative
body of the state of Arizona ceding the land to the federal government. Now, how are they ignoring that? Should come immediately to all of your minds. What happened in Oklahoma City recently? A federal building blew up, didn't it? Did the United States have authority or jurisdiction over that property?
No.
Why not? Because even today, they can't find any evidence that the legislature of the state of Oklahoma ceded that property to the federal government. In that case, does the federal government have jurisdiction to try Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols? No. It was a state matter, state jurisdiction, state venue from beginning to end. So they have succeeded in exceeding the limitations, lawful limitations of the Constitution, haven't they? What else did they do that was unconstitutional? The venue, what did they do? They moved the trial to Colorado. What does the Constitution say? All trials for all crimes will be held in the state where the crime occurred. It's in the Constitution. It's the supreme law of the land. You cannot move the trial to another state. Isn't that incredible? They do it every day. And most Americans are so brainwashed they never question it. You know why they never question it? Because they never read the Constitution, and those that did don't understand it. They've been taught that it was written by a bunch of doddering old men over 200 years ago who don't understand the complexities of the modern age, and that for some reason they weren't writing in English, so what they wrote, we should not be able to understand, must be interpreted for us. Bullshit. Total crap. It's a lie. Beginning to see, jurisdiction is a big thing. Almost everybody who immediately challenges jurisdiction when they are arrested within the territorial boundaries of a state and hauled into a federal court are set free. How many people do that? Almost none. Very few. They have no jurisdiction. Period. Other than in these areas, the clause of the Constitution did not operate to cede further jurisdiction to the federal government, and jurisdiction over those areas which had not been so ceded remained within the states. And still to this day, without a legislative act of the legislature of the state, they don't have any. While there had been no real provisions in the Articles which permitted the Confederation Congress to acquire property and possess exclusive jurisdiction over the property, the above clause filled an essential need by permitting the federal government to acquire land for the seat of government and other purposes from certain of the states. These lands were deemed essential to enable the United States to perform the powers delegated by the Constitution, and a cession of lands by any particular state would grant exclusive jurisdiction of them to Congress. Perhaps the best explanations for this clause in the Constitution were set forth in essay number 43 of The Federalist. Quote, "The indispensable necessity of complete authority at the seat of government carries its own evidence with it. It is a power exercised by every legislature of the Union, I might say of the world, by virtue of its general supremacy. Without it, not only the public authority might be insulted and its procedures interrupted with impunity, but a dependence of the members of the general government on the state comprehending the seat of the government for protection and the exercise of their duty might bring on the national councils an imputation of all our influence equally dishonorable to the government and dissatisfaction to the other members of the Confederacy. This consideration has the more weight as the gradual accumulation of public improvements at the stationary residence of the government would be both too great a public pledge to be left in the hands of a single state, and would create so many obstacles to a removal of the government as still further to abridge its necessary independence. The extent of this federal district is sufficiently circumscribed to satisfy every jealousy of an opposite nature, and as it is to be appropriated to this use with the consent of the state ceding it, as the state will no doubt provide in the compact for the rights and the consent of the citizens inhabiting it, as the inhabitants will find sufficient inducements of interest to become willing parties to the cession, as they will have had their voice in the election of the government which is to exercise authority over them as a municipal legislature for local purposes derived from their own suffrages will of course be allowed them, and as the authority of the legislature of the state and of the inhabitants of the ceded part of it to concur in the session will be derived from the whole people of the state in their adoption of the Constitution, every imaginable objection seems to be obviated. The necessity of a like authority over forts, magazines, etc., established by the general government is not less evident. The public money expended on such places and the public property deposited in them require that they should be exempt from the authority of the particular state, nor would it be proper for the places on which the security of the entire Union may depend to be in any degree dependent on a particular member of it. All objections and scruples are here also obviated by requiring the concurrence of the states concerned in every such establishment." End quote.
We will continue with this same lecture tomorrow on the Hour of the Time. Good night, folks. God bless each and every single one of you. And may God save this great republic.